Investor Coaching Show. Paul Winkler. Talk about the world of money, investing, and just what it takes to get from A to B for you. You know, the financial process, a lot of people struggle with how to get ahead. I taught a workshop this week, and I thought I would share some of the contents of the workshop with you just simply because it was a fun workshop to go through. I ought to do it, probably ought to do this in one of our offices with more detail, but you know, I'm going to give you what I can here because, you know, I appreciate you guys. I saw this week that our podcasts and how many downloads we're getting on the podcast and how many people are checking that out at paulwinkler.com. You can go and download the podcast. And just thank you, those of you, you know, the kind comments. Man, that was so cool. So nice to see that you guys are getting some out of this show. And the podcast, of course, because you can download and listen to it anytime. So I was doing this workshop. It just makes me want to go and just do more for you guys. You know, it does. It really motivates when people appreciate what you do. So thank you, thank you, thank you. So the workshop I was teaching to some guys that were in a blue-collar field, you know, was who wants to be a millionaire? So, you know, they asked me, hey, can you teach us something? We got a lot of people at this one company that, I help them out with their 401k. And I said, can you teach us something practical? You know, just tell us some success stories, investing success stories. And you know, I thought, you know, how about this? How about just people's success stories when it comes to money in general? So I did this, you know, who wants to be a millionaire? And, you know, the question I asked him, I said, what would you guys do with $1 million? You know, everybody always thinks that, you know, what would I do if I had $1 million? I'll never forget asking that question one time. And, you know, I got the weirdest answer. I said, I'm never going to ask that question again. So I broke my own rule. I asked these guys this. And they were just like, you know what? I don't know. What would I do? And I says, you know, I used to work for a company that serviced New York State Lottery. And I saw just some weird stuff where people would just get a lot of money. And then all of a sudden, they get this big bunch of money, and then a year later, 2 years later, they're back in the position that they were where they started. And I've seen it where people, you know, get a lot of money, and then they go and buy a house for somebody, they buy cars, and it's just amazing. They will blow it on stuff. And, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about where I see that, what's actually going on there in a second. I'll get to that. But, you know, the odds that you'll win the lottery, number one. You know, some people say, if I win the lottery, I'll do this, and I'll, you know, give this much to the church, and blah, 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 blah. Like, going, yeah, right. Like, God wants in on that one. But the odds that we win the lottery are 1 in 175 million. I mean, your odds of really doing that is not that great. But it's interesting, if you look at 2018, how many millionaires were there in the United States? It was almost 12 million millionaires in the United States. It's a lot of people, right? Millionaires in the United States, it's 1 in 28. The odds of becoming a millionaire through more reasonable means is pretty stinking high when it really gets on down to it. When you look at what the opportunities that there are still in America. A lot of people say, oh, it's just America's dead, it's gone, blah, blah, the American dream's dead. And I was like, no, it's not. I see this every day in our practice where people just have done phenomenally well. And I love to ask them, you know, how did you get there? Now, there was a study of millionaires and how many of them own businesses. It's about like a third. And you've got a whole bunch of people right now coming up that are very entrepreneurial. You know, there are more small businesses being open right now than ever. And, you know, people try to say, well, millennials, a bunch of socialists. No, they're not. They just don't know what it means. You know, they look at it and they think, oh, it just means that, one guy joked that it means I'm social. No, that's not. But you know, they own businesses. And the reality is, I was thinking about this morning. I see, you know, people use the analogy that, you know, well, socialism, of course, you know, just taking all of successes and then just spreading out the wealth. You know, so if you're successful, you know, take money from you and give it to somebody that hasn't done anything. And you know, you look at it, and nobody does that around grades. They often talk about that in school. You know, if you get A's, you know, then what we're going to do is we're going to take your A from you and we're going to give it to this D student that didn't study at all. And, you know, we don't want that in anything. It would be like a musician. Now, if everybody could be an absolutely unbelievable musician, well, just, you know, let's just go and give your musical skills to everybody. And let's say that if you didn't have to work for it, let's put it a different way. Let's say that you didn't have to practice. You didn't have to go in there and work on it, you know, do those doggone scales or whatever, you know, do the coordination exercises. You know, why would you do any of that junk? Why would you put forth any of that effort if becoming a great musician was just a matter of being, you know, wave a magic wand and you're a great musician? Why would you go forth and put any effort into anything that you do? I mean, just think of anything you do, becoming a great cook or, you know, becoming, you know, a great athlete or anything like that. Why work out? Why go to the gym? Oh my goodness, that's painful. Go to the gym and lift weights like that and put yourself through that. Running sprints, wind sprints. Oh my goodness, what if it could be conveyed upon you? You know, nobody thinks that's a reasonable way of looking at life. I mean, it's just a silly kind of a concept. And, you know, so people think that, well, you know, people think it's social. You know, they're not. They just don't get. I'm just convinced that they don't get what it is. And, you know, what's happening, it's interesting, it's sad. There was a study that we were talking about people, younger people, between the ages of 25 and 29. And the level of depression is just unbelievable. And I saw it again this week, another study that reiterated that. And the point that was being made is you know, that they are getting to the point in their lives where they realize, you know, all their idealism is actually a bit misconstrued, and that really the idealism isn't, you know, they're not finding that they can change the world in the way they thought they were going to be able to change the world, right? You know, so back to our businesses, okay? And you know, you come to that point though, and it's important to get the idea that when you get to that point where maybe the world just doesn't work the way you thought it did, and maybe all these things that you thought would be reasonable, all the idealistic principles that you held forever aren't reasonable, then what you do is you go, okay, well, maybe my parents weren't so stupid. Or maybe, you know, there is a different, you have to take human nature into account. That, you know, the reality is you do have to hold a carrot out in front of somebody in order to motivate them to go the extra mile. You know, the entrepreneur that builds the business and puts forth all that effort and the long hours and the amount of time. And maybe they ought to be able to keep the fruits of their labors. And you know, they become they become realistic that that's the way the world works. Well, you know, the point I was making to these people, because it was a blue-collar group, right, is that a third of millionaires own their own business. Well, you know, think of it this way. That means two-thirds don't. So you don't have to be a business owner. You know, only 20% of millionaires inherited their wealth. It's 80% of them first-generation rich. You know, so you think about it, they put away the money themselves. So you think about, you know, retirement. What do you want it to look like? And it's really important that you get really crystal clear on the day in the life of the retired you. You know, what are you going to do in the morning? Where are you going to be waking up? What are you going to be doing? What are you going to get up and get out of bed for? You know, what do you want that to look like? What do you want the house to look like? What do you want, you know, the people, the relationships that you have, the people that you're going to meet with during the day and people that you're going to spend time with, what do you want that to look like? Because the more clear you get on that, the more it's likely to happen. Now, some people say you're going to need about 70% of, you know, whatever you're earning before you're retired to live in retirement. And, you know, one of the things that I talk about is something called a smile retirement, where you typically need a lot of income at the beginning of your retirement and less further on. And there's a really interesting study on that where there was a gentleman by the name of David Blanchett, and he was looking at, if your income was $25,000, you know, you'll start off needing all of that income in retirement, at least. And you might drop down to where maybe you need somewhere in the neighborhood of about, he came to his conclusion, it was about $22,500 or somewhere in that neighborhood by the ages of 85 to 90, you wouldn't need as much because you're not going to be doing as much. Now, on 25,000, you don't get to do a whole heck of a lot. But so you don't have much of a drop in your spending level as time goes on. And then your spending level goes up later on, you know, as you get into your 90s, if you make it that far, then you're going to have more spending on healthcare. But the reality of it is a lot of times when you have lower income people, they don't have as long of life expectancies due to, you know, eating choices, medical choices and things like that. That's the reality. Now, they looked at a $50,000 level, and they needed all of that $50,000 when they retired. But then it dropped to about 40 or so that they needed later on. They wouldn't have to spend as much because they weren't traveling as much. Then the $100,000 level, they needed all of that at the beginning because they were used to spending that level of income, $100,000. And those people had dropped to about 70. You know, so they started off at about 100, and then they dropped to about 70. And then all three groups, actually, the spending went up as they got older because medical expenses started to creep up on you. So it just gives you some idea of what's needed. There was one guy, actually, professor of economics, Dan Ariely, or I don't know how you pronounce his name, but it's A-R-I-E-L-Y. But anyway, he had research showing that you needed about 135% of your final income when you jump into retirement. And that's because people like to, you know, they go out to travel and things like that. Now, they found that about 79%, 8 in 10 people felt assured that they had the best retirement strategies. That's it. Not many people, they didn't feel assured, I should have said, that they didn't feel assured that they had the right investment strategies. And, you know, that study I found interesting because I find that most investments, like the target funds that I talk about here on the show, investment portfolios that people have at work, typically not terribly academically sound is the way they're put together. They ignore a lot of the academic research on, you know, small companies and value companies and how to put portfolios together. They lean very heavy large U.S., which, you know, as I've talked about in recent shows, has been a great strategy in the past couple of years. Just historically, it doesn't work that well. Long run, you look at significantly lower accumulation rates when you're putting all your money in an area of the market that has the lowest long-term expected return. I mean, think about it. Large U.S. companies, they're big, they're well-known, they're well-liked. They don't have to historically pay that much to use your money. They don't have to pay as much as other areas of the market, and therefore the returns end up being less, right? Of course, that makes sense. Cost of capital is return on capital. So if we look at large companies and we see that our portfolio is dominated by them, you can pretty much expect that the returns would be lower. That doesn't mean you don't do your 401k. You absolutely do, but you might have to tweak it. Don't use their, I don't like using what the fund companies come up with as an asset mix. You got to realize the asset mix that they come up for you is more for their benefit than it is yours. Because they know that if you are mainly put in large U.S. companies, you are more likely to stick with it because large U.S. companies, that's all the media reports on. I was talking to somebody today about that. I said, you know, it's interesting. You know, I do the show on WTN, been doing this show for many years on this station, and I talk about how people rail against the media and how misleading it is and how terrible and blah, blah, blah. And I go, but they believe the media when it comes to the market. You know, and all they talk about is one area of the market. And, you know, there was one day this week that, you had this thing with the Fed where the Fed was reducing interest rates and this media headline, the Fed reduces interest rates and the market's happy about it. It goes up. And I'm going, you know what? If you look at the markets in the United States, there were some international markets that went up, some that went down. But just look at the U.S. markets, large companies, small, large value, small value. There was only one area of the market that went up based on that. And it was large U.S. companies just happened to. Now, the previous days, that was the area that went down, 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 while other areas went up. So, you know, but the point is this. You know, they'll say the market went down today. And I'm like, small caps did great today. Or, you know, international did phenomenal. You know, international, they had a great day today. And that's all they focus on. And I said, well, you know, here's the deal. You rail against the media, when it comes to all of their talk about, you know, with the political things going on, and what are they doing with this, and what's this person saying, and you know, you talk about the misleading and the fake news, as they like to call it, right? And then you don't realize it's the same fake news for different reasons in the financial world. It's just nuts. But, you know, so people look at it and say, well, I don't have the best stuff available. Well, typically you do have some things in your 401k that are worth looking at. It's just when they allocate it, they being the fund companies, the investment companies, you typically won't have a great mix because they will allocate more to one area of the market, the one that you focus on, which is large U.S. stocks, because you're more likely to stick with it because that's all you watch every day. If the market goes up, your fund goes up, you're cool. If the market goes down, your fund goes down, you're not happy about it, but you're more likely to stick with it. You know, so what happens is those periods of time, and this is what fund companies get really antsy about, those period of times like the late 90s and just recently where large U.S. stocks did better than other areas, and that's all people look at is large U.S. stocks, well, you're more likely to bail out and do something, you know, shoot yourself in the foot by selling a diversified mix and going to all U.S. large. And people did that in the late 90s to their detriment when large U.S. stocks went down 40% to 80%. You know, they end up, that was what happened to them. And they end up all in that area of the market. And when it came crumbling down, then they couldn't retire. And then they say, oops, that wasn't a real good idea. Okay, I'm going to take a quick break, be right back after this. I'm going to talk about, you know, the percentage of Americans when they're going to retire, you know, what those years are, what they think that they're going to retire, and how you're going to get there. Paul Winkler, listening to the Investor Coaching Show on Supertalk 99.7 WTN. Paul Winkler.
Not tonight.
Investor Coaching Show. Super Talk 99.7 WTN. Podcast, PaulWinkler.com. PaulWinkler.com. And you may be very well listening to it right there. So you can check it out there and the videos and all the content that's going to be changing as time goes on there. All kinds of new stuff coming. So be checking out the website. Kind of exciting things that are going to be happening there. Okay, so you know, we're talking about Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Did this little workshop for you know, some guys and a big group of guys. I'd say some 40, 50 guys in attendance. And, you know, this group of people, they were in a blue-collar field, so, you know, not really high incomes by any stretch of the imagination. And, you know, a lot of people, those people that say, well, I can't do it. There's no way. You know, I can't ever get there. That's, you know, other people get rich, not guys like me and a couple of gals. So, you know, here's what I talked to them about. I says, you know, how are you going to get there? You know, some people think, well, you know, how am I going to get to retirement and have a great, successful retirement? And they think, well, maybe Social Security will do it. And the study shows about 56% of Americans don't really understand Social Security. And, you know, if you look at it, the reality is about 40% of what you need in retirement will come from Social Security. That's one of the estimates. And the benefits, yeah, we're looking at a possibility of reduction in benefits by 21% is one estimate. That when the surplus is spent down, and you know the other things, there are other things we have up against us. You know, the human body doesn't get less expensive as we age. You know, 65-year-old couple retiring in 2019, they're expected to have about $285,000 in healthcare expenses and medical expenses throughout retirement. You know, for guys, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $135,000, $150,000 for women. You know, so it, you know, getting old is not cheap, and you know, people wonder, okay, how am I going to live comfortably with all of that up against me? And a lot of people say that it's just not going to happen. You know, I'm not going to be able to. I'm not going to be able to afford this. You know, retirement is just not an option. But the reality is most people are retired by about age 70, that most people do get to retirement one way or another. But, you know, here's the reality. About one in four people, oh, that's about it, feel financially prepared for retirement. And a lot of people feel this way because they're not really seriously preparing. You know, there's one study has showed 78% of Americans living paycheck to paycheck. 78%. Only about one in five actually know what they need to retire is one estimate. There was one study I talked about. You know, so a lot of people don't really even know what it's going to take to get there. And 26% of people, they have less than $1,000 saved for retirement. It's about a quarter of people, less than $1,000 saved. And, you know, about half people have their less than $25,000 saved. And there's 50% of Americans, one of the studies I shared with these people, have less than 3 months saved. And that's what you ought to have, an emergency fund, right? Half of people don't have as much as you ought to have in just emergency money set aside, you know, just in savings and a money market account or something like that. And there are about a third of people don't have any savings, period, end of sentence, nothing. You know, so the question you ask, well, why am I in this position? Why are we in this position? And I said, you know, so this sounds dire, but why are we in the position that we're in as Americans? A lot of people are just, I'll catch up later. I'll get to it. But the reality is, you've heard this stuff before, and I'm not telling you anything new if you've listened to me or any other financial talk for any period of time. Let's say you're 23 years old, and for 10 years you save $100 a month. And let's say that you manage to get an 8% rate of return, and you know at retirement time you end up with, you know, at age 65 you end up with, you put away $12,000, so you put $100 a month per month away. So it's, you know, $1,200 a year, obviously, times 10 years, $12,000. And at that rate of return, you end up with about $225,000. But let's say that you said, nah, I'm going to wait. And you start at age 35 and you go all the way to age 65. So in that case, you've saved for 30 years, and that's $12,000 per decade, right? $1,200 per year. That's $36,000 saved. How much money do you have? Instead of $225,000, it's $150,000. Now you saved a whole lot more money and you ended up with a whole lot less. Why? Because most of what you're going to have in retirement is not money that you put away. It's what it grew to if you are investing and you captured that rate of return that I use, which is 8%. And you look at large U.S. stocks, the absolute worst 30-year period in all of history, you've heard me say this before, was 1929 to 1958. And it was 8.5% return. You know, most every other area of the market that I would use, like small companies and small value and large value and international large and international small, had higher returns than that. But in essence, just take a look at that right there and say, okay, so if I had invested it and I captured the return historically of the market, that's what it ends up at, right? Now, when you're not saving and you're going to be spending, and a lot of times you pick up some really bad habits. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about some of the bad habits that we tend to pick up. You know, what is it that we tend to do as investors, and what are the habits, or as non-investors, really, some of the habits we have are non-investing related. And what are they, and how do we start to get a handle on these things? Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show, Supertalk 99.7 WTN.
Yep, and I'm back.
Investor Coaching Show, Paul Winkler, talking about the world of money and investing. So, getting to be the millionaire. Kind of a topic that I've been on for a little bit here, and I'm going to share a couple different things this week than some of the previous stuff that I've gotten into, because I want to get into a little deeper on something on here. So why is it people aren't saving? Why are they spending so much and they're developing all these really bad habits? And it's something I think about a lot. You know, what is it about the psychology of it? If you look at where does money go? It's interesting because there was a whole thing from the Department of Labor where they were looking at where people are spending money. It's, you know, on a $50,000 income, about $8,000 they figure is spent on transportation, about almost $9,000. So about 17%, which is pretty high, on getting from A to B. You know, think about that. That's a pretty big number right there. Entertainment, about 5% on entertainment, you know, and another 12% is on food, you know, so spend a lot of money on food, maybe going out to eat and things like that. And a lot of times you hear financial planners that talk, don't go out to eat. And it's a big deal, but where is most of it going? Well, we just named one, transportation. And then insurance, of course, is going to be a fairly decent chunk, about 10%. Pensions and insurance, they lump those together for some crazy reason. I'm not sure why. Healthcare, it was 5% on healthcare. And for some people, they can get pretty doggone high right there. That bankrupts a lot of people. But housing was the biggest chunk. It's about 34% of this person, you know, the $50,000 person that they used in their Department of Labor study, about 34%, 35% was spent on housing, which is, you know, about $16,000 a year. And then, of course, you know, a lot of times you'll hear financial people say, well, you don't go to Starbucks all the time. And, you know, that can get up there. The average person that's a customer of Starbucks goes 6 times per month. $550 per year is what they spend on that. But, you know, I want to harken back to those other ones, you know, the housing and the vehicles and things like, because I think those are really big ones. And, you know, we get in these habits and we tend to buy, you've heard this before, bigger houses than we probably ought to have and nicer cars and really fancy things. And you think about, where does this stuff come from? And a lot of it comes from when we're kids, right? You have these winning formulas. And I talked about this before, but, you know, when you get picked on as a kid and, you know, it almost seems like the universal rite of passage that kids will pick on you and you go through experiences where you're rejected or nobody likes me, you know, everybody hates me, nobody likes me, I guess I'll go eat worms, right? You know, that type of thing, where you're rejected by a group of people that you want so badly to accept you. And reality of it is there's people are just not going to accept you. I mean, that's just the way it goes. And, you know, what happens is do we many times grow up and go, I want their approval so bad that I want to go back to the class reunion. I want to show that I was a success and be bigger, badder, better, have a nicer house, nicer car, you know, impress people and say, hey, I made it. And how often is that because of some inadequacy we have in ourselves, just thinking I'm not good enough? And I got to prove that I am good enough. And I find that that is something that eats people's lunches. I mean, think about it. You know, we grow up and we want to, and so what we do is we, you know, buy cars that are way above what we should be. And it's just getting A to B. You know, some of my more successful clients, and I got a lot of really successful clients, and I ask them about that, and they're like, nah, I'm not out there trying to impress anybody with what I drive. Car's 10 years old, 15 years old, or, you know, house is way less than what we technically could afford. But, you know, when it comes to getting a mortgage, we're told how much we could afford. And typically what happens is people, you know, they're, ooh, I want that. And it was interesting because I got into a conversation with one of the guys afterward, and it was a really one of those deep conversations you just love having with people. I love having with people. And he says, well, you know what? I have this thing that he really likes. And he says, I just get so much joy out of it. And it was collecting something. And I says, well, you know, it's there's nothing wrong with that. I says, I typically save first and I spend what's left over. And, you know, when I'm saving what I should be saving, and, you know, find the wealthy people typically save 15, 20, 25%. You know, there's some people out there, you know, you got that, and I talked about this before, where you have the FIRE movement, you know, financial independence, retire early, and they're saving, you know, 50, 60, 70% of their income, which is, you know, just overboard the other direction. You know, for a lot of people look at it and go, I'm just not doing that. I'm not saving 70% of my income just so I can quit my work and get out and, you know, do nothing and vegetate for the rest of my life. And some people, you know, might be perfectly fine because maybe they have hobbies or other things that they want to do with their lives, where they don't need much to live on, and they can do that. And then, you know, maybe work isn't the meaning that for them that it is for somebody like me, or where I derive great meaning out of my work. And, you know, imagine retiring, it would be just bleh, yuck. But maybe that's not you. But anyway, so we're talking about, I said, I save first and I spend what's left over. And you know, it's nobody's business what I spend on, you know, nicely speaking. You know, don't tell me that I have to drive a 10-year-old used car, or I have to live in a shack or anything like that. As you know, as I'm saving what I should be saving, and I'm doing what I ought to be doing and being responsible, don't tell me what I ought to be spending on. You know, some people are budgeters. I have guys that work for me that they love budgeting. They're just great at it. And it's just like, that's never been me. And I said, but does it really, really make whatever you're collecting? I said, because, you know, there are things that I love, but I find as more I collect, I said, the more it becomes a burden to me. And the more stuff I have, I sit there and go, oh. And I was just like, ah, oh, it's more stuff to keep track of and take care of and maintain. And at some point, you know, these things that seem to make you happy actually suck away your happiness. They actually go the other direction for you. And I said, you know, studies show that people, they get way more out of experiences than getting more stuff. And the reality of it is when you get older, your relationships are way, way more important than the things that you've collected. You know, the relationships that you have are, you know, and that's free. You know, that stuff is free. You know, it doesn't cost anything to, you know, pick up the phone, call up and say, and get together with a friend or a family member, or, you know, kids or, you know, a spouse, or go hang out and spend time. And I told a story, you know, this guy that when he passed away, you know, there was, you know, you wonder how much of this stuff is real, but the story was great, so I'm going to repeat it. It was sent to me by a friend of mine that you know, lives in another state, and he sent it and says, you know, you might like this, and I loved it. It was a guy had young kid had spent a lot of time in this guy's house, and there was a box on the shelf, and that box, he never would tell him what was in it. And then he says, you know what's in that? And he goes, nah, it's just the thing is just most valuable to me. It's the thing that is just absolutely has the most value. And he never would tell him what was in it. Well, he passed away, and his mom says, you know, so-and-so passed away and says, you're going to go to the funeral. And he says, oh, yeah. So he goes, and not many people there. Well, he goes to his house, and he says it was walking into the past for him, walking into this house, and he noticed that the box was gone, and you know, long story short, the guy sent the box to him, and he always wondered what was in it. What was in that box that was the most important thing to this man that I held so dear and I spent so much time with and listened to his stories and talked to him, and just, you know, and it reminded me when I was a kid, there was a pastor that lived next door to me, and you know, he spent so much time with me and would read books to me. I remember it was Jack and the Beanstalk. He would read that book to me every day. And when he moved away, he read it to me one more time. And I think, wow, you know, the time this guy spent with me. So anyway, the package goes back to him. And he opens it up, and he can't wait to see what's in the box. What was in a box was a watch. And a thank you note for all the time he had spent with him. And I thought, wow, you know, that's it, man. That's what's important. And, you know, how much more time do you have when you've put some money away for the future? And you've done what you needed to do so that now you can spend lots of time with quality time with the people you love and you care about. Well, what stops us from doing it is typically, you know, this whole thing about, you know, trying to impress a bunch of people from the past or people that are in our lives right now to show them how great we are and how successful we are. And I'm not pointing fingers. It's just what we all are. It's how we all are, isn't it? We tend to be trapped by it. Well, so you might say, I'll never be a millionaire. And I'm just going to hit that right after this break. You're listening to the Investor Coaching Show. Super Talk 99.7 WTN.
All right. Back here on the Investor Coaching Show. Paul Winkler. About world money investing.
So, he's finishing up this thing on I'll never be a millionaire. How do I get there? How do millionaires get there? You know, when somebody says, I can't, I'll never make it. Can't ever be there. Can't make it as a millionaire. And, you know, there's some people that it's really too late. You can't get there because, you know, not by next year anyway or something like that, unless you win the lottery. If you're 64 and you want to be millionaire by 65 or 65, you want to be a millionaire by 66 or whatever, and you don't have anything saved, well, it might be a little difficult. But for younger people, you know, I always tell them, if you think you can, you think you can't, you're probably right. That was a Henry Ford saying where he said, you know, if you think you can't do something, you think you can do it. If I think I can, I'm going to find ways to do it. If I can't think that's impossible, I won't even try. You know, so that's really what it gets down to. It's, you know, where's my mindset regarding this? And look at the FIRE movement. These people are saving 70% of their income. Why? Because they think they can. And they're going to do it. And they're living like paupers. And, you know, it's what you do is you decide that's I'm willing to live that way. And I'm not advocating it by any stretch of the imagination. But some of my wealthiest clients came from nothing. And they had things that they lived by, that, you know, such as that success wasn't an accident. Success is a choice. You decide. And, you know, the other thing that I always like to refer people to is The Richest Man in Babylon, where they said, you know, the part of all you earn is yours to keep. You pay your auto insurance, pay your homeowner's insurance, you pay for your light bill and your electric bill and your phone bill. And, well, you know, part of what you earn should be yours to keep. You ought to keep it for yourself. But when you hear these messages that are so destructive throughout life, that he who dies with the most toys wins. Nah, they still dead. You know, it's kind of a silly notion, isn't it? If you got more stuff than somebody else, you've won. And, you know, the thing is, it doesn't have to hurt that much when you're saving for retirement and you're putting money away, you know, because especially in your 401ks, you get the benefit of the tax deduction on the contribution on traditional plans. So, you know, you might be putting away 10% of your income, but it feels like 8 or something like that, you know, depending on your tax bracket. And then, of course, with compounding, you know, you put money away, and like I said earlier, the fraction of what you put away was what you put away. Most of it's the growth, if you have growth in the investments and just capture market returns. Based on history, that's been where most of the return has come from. You know, you can do even better than that because of the fact that you got with 401ks at work, you got matches on the contributions. You know, a lot of times you'll have a safe harbor contribution. Some companies have safe harbor plans where they'll match, you put away 4%, they'll match 4%. So you're right up to 8% right away. And even if they don't match, you still get the benefit of the tax deduction, and it's automatic. That's what I love about 401k plans. And there was a thing New York Times did, and I shared that with these guys as well. But they had this 1% more savings calculator. And they used an example of if you just put away 1% of your salary, you know, this year, let's say you're saving nothing. You put away 1%, then you add another percent the next year, and add another percent the year after that, and you just keep adding 1% per year. Because you think about it, you get raises over time, so you just start putting a portion of raise. You don't even have to put all your raise. Now, I might be tempted to put all my raise away for a few years to get up to the point where I'm saving, you know, 10, 15, 20% of income, and you know, it might take 5, 10 years before you get there, but you get there, and, you know, if you're young enough, that can be a huge deal. And then what ends up happening is you end up with this great accumulation down the road, and it was pretty painless because you just added a little bit and you increased your contribution a little bit every single year. Now, some companies, that's an automatic thing. You actually have to choose not to be in that program. But as your salary grows, your paycheck grows, and your contributions grow, and you end up, you know, let's say you had a $30,000 income, and you only did 10%, you know, and that was all that you just never got above that, and you never increased it, okay? You never increased it for inflation. So you say it $3,000 per year for every year. But, you know, at a 10% return, let's say, that's about $500,000. 7%, that's $283,000. And for a person making a $30,000 income, that may be all they may not need a full $1 million in today's dollars. Now, when I use 7%, I'm typically thinking in after inflation rates of return. So you can think of the number that's accumulated in today's dollars. You know, so if I look at large U.S. stocks, remember I said historically 10% return. After inflation, it's 7. Small companies, it's 9. After inflation, it's about 12, and it's about a 9% after inflation rate of return. So, you know, that's when I'm projecting. I'm typically using after inflation numbers when I do my projections. But you think about it, if you're at $60,000 level, well, that 10% rate of return gets you up to $1 million right there over a 30-year period. And the reality of it is you can probably get way above that 10% contribution level if you're just a little diligent and not, you know, pulled in by, you know, the new shiny cars all the time and then, you know, bigger houses and you just look at ways that you can just put more away. And that's the idea, is just you can get there just by being conscious of where money's going. What are you spending it on? And making sure that you follow the tenets that I teach on this show and that we teach our clients, which is global diversification. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. And don't do what a lot of people are doing right now, which is stick it all in just big U.S. companies. And because you can go 20-year periods. You know, two of them last century, and we had literally more than a decade, just so far this century, as new as this century is, where there was zero return in that area of the market. Rebalance the portfolio on a regular basis. Just don't leave it there. Make sure that it's managed. And when one area of the market's doing better than another, instead of buying more of it, you sell some of it and buy the other areas. It's not easy to do. You know, don't be buying life insurance policies as an accumulation vehicle. It's a terrible accumulation vehicle. You know, so once you get to that status, then you can start to live off of the income that you've accumulated. You know, the reality of it is, it's 56%. Of workers, back to that study, have less than $25,000 in investments. That's pretty bad. They don't accumulate anything. And, you know, maybe because they've been burnt by the stock market, maybe they've done it wrong before, and they just, that's it, the stock. And, you know, what happened? I lost money. What did I make up about it? I made up that the stock market's terrible. It's a bad place to invest. It doesn't have good returns. It doesn't, people just lose their money there. It's just a gambling casino. You get all of this stuff. This is why becoming educated about investing is so important. It's not that hard. And then have somebody that's guiding you that knows what they're doing. Studies show that people that work with planners work with a planner and actually do this and keeps them accountable and keeps them disciplined. They do way better. You know what? The reality of it is kind of like diet and exercise. It's really, really easy to talk about, really hard to do when it gets down to it. Take the first step. Journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. That's the most important thing that you can do as an investor. Take the first step. PaulWinkler.com is that website. So call us the office, 615-851-1950. That gets you to any of the 10 offices. 615-851-1950, PaulWinkler.com. This is the Investor Coaching Show. This is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there. And if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Till next week, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that educated investors are more confident investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one.